This is Alex Castro. We are conducting an interview this afternoon, June the 7th, 1982, with John Klein Mann, a longtime member of the Outrigger Canoe Club. We are sitting in the Outrigger dining room, and it is now 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The water is very malia, and there's just a few waves out on the reef. And now we go to the interview. Klein, how did you first become interested in the Outrigger Canoe Club?
I became interested originally as a kid, being brought to the club by my father, who was a member for many, many years. I did not become a member at that time during my schooling in Honolulu, mainly because I indulged in sports at Punahou School. And on weekends, we went to Mukulikia Beach, where we had a beach home from 1927, every weekend and practically every summer. So that at the time I went off to college, I was not a member. I didn't become a member until after my return after World War II. And 1 month or two after I got back in 1946, I did become a member. I joined as a regular member in February 1946. My dad was one of my sponsors. My other sponsor was our family doctor, who had brought me into this world, Dr. Guy C. Milner, longtime member of the club. My participation from the time I joined was as a member that participated in the volleyball and the swimming and all the activities at the club. I did not, however, compete in paddling, nor other team sports representing the club. I participated from the very beginning on various committees. I believe every single committee that I can think of, except the House Committee. And my participation in committee work continued from 1946 up to 1960, at which time I was nominated to board of directors of the Outrigger Canoe Club and was elected 1946, February. I was immediately given a jolt by being elected the secretary of the club, which was rather an unheard of thing for freshman directors. And I had many friends on the board at the time, past presidents, Godbold, Danford, Taylor, Marty Anderson, just to think of four past presidents who joined in the railroad of my being nominated and selected as secretary.
Did you resent being nominated, or were you just merely surprised?
I was more than just surprised, I was shocked. But I was not resentful. I was told by my colleagues that they wanted me, and they sincerely expressed that, and I assumed the job with that, in that light. It was a rather frightening experience to come in and have to be the secretary without any real background, except my participation since 1946. Now, the first thing I did, however, was to get permission to take home the volumes containing all the minutes of the board of directors, beginning with the special meeting of the Outrigger Canoe Club in July 1939, which was the date at which the club really was reorganized for the purpose of building a new club at what we now call the old site. I prefer to call that the old new club or the new old club. If you recall, the club was founded in 1908, and the first 5 years was on a rather informal lease arrangement with the trustee of the Queen Emma estate. In 1913, where we're given a 25-year lease, which lease expired in 1938. The next lease the club had was really a sublease to Matson, who took over the premises of the Queen Emma estate on the Makaisata Kalakaua. So we became, in fact, a tenant of Matson Navigation Company. So in 1939, a year after that lease, the club was ready to begin its financing campaign and membership campaign to put together funds for the then new old club. It happened that my dad was elected at that board of directors meeting of July 1939 and was named the chairman of the building committee, which had charge of the planning and the building of what I call the old new club. The club was completed in December of 1940, and from that point on, I visited the club on numerous occasions with my family as a guest. I believe it was Kamehameha Day of June 1941 when the club premises were officially vacated. Shortly after that, I went off to college. The war came. I did not return until after the war was POW, at which time I was immediately brought to the club by my dad, who saw that I was properly sponsored and within a very short time was elected to membership. As I said, I participated in all the camaraderie and the social athletic functions of the club, all along consuming rather large quantities of beer with my friends on the Howe Terrace and having a hell of a good time from the years 1946 to 1960.
But you were never in the competitive, on any of the competitive teams, is that correct?
That's correct. I served on the canoe committee and the volleyball committee under people like Dope Yap and others. Let me just keep going. At the same time, I was a member of the board of directors and the secretary of it. I also was named the planning committee. The planning committee had been functioning for several years pursuant to the fact that the club had entered into a lease with the Elks Club, 99-year lease, commencing November 15th, 1956, to occupy one half of the former castle property. There were many people who voted for that particular lease at the time it came up for membership approval, who nevertheless thought that we would never, ever occupy those premises, but would instead find some way to remain at the old site. The committee continued under the chairmanship of Bus Rainalter, who was a member of the board of directors and a vice president. And at the end of my first year on the board, Bus was off and out of the board of directors, and I was named his successor as chairman of that committee. Sometime after I was elected, I discovered that those who promoted my election were those who were rather prominent in a group which sought to remain at the old premises. I did not know this, but it wasn't very long after my being elected that I realized from all the evidence that remaining at the old site was simply not feasible for many reasons, not only economically, but the tremendous changes that had come upon that particular center of gravity of Waikiki, which occurred after the end of World War II and the advent of big promotion of tourism at the Royal Hawaiian and the Moana Hotel, and shortly thereafter other hotels in Waikiki. And it just seemed to me that the club atmosphere that we'd enjoyed all those many years could not possibly survive in competition with the other factors that were so important. At the time the club was dedicated, 1940, the club had what is called a club license, club liquor license. One of the provisions of that type of license is that sales cannot be made to any except members or the members' guests. Something very difficult to police unless we had a credit system. But of course, you remember we didn't. Cash from the beginning was the usual method of paying, and of course had to be during the war and continued in all of those post-war years up to the time that we're making these decisions in 1960 1961 and 2. One of the very bad features that the club experienced was after Sheraton purchased the Royal Hawaiian and Moana properties in 1958, and shortly thereafter got the club to approve the building of a boardwalk between the Royal and the Moana. And this just kept, this allowed pedestrian traffic on the beach instead of just on Kalakaua Avenue. And the club was open from one end to the Mauka end to the Makai end, with people coming in and out who had no business being on the premises. They could pass into the Hau Terrace, sit down, purchase booze, pay cash. This is one of the bad features that we were experiencing at that time. Shortly before we moved back down here, however, the board of directors put a stop to that situation, and we did cut it off. But the point is that we were a target. We were a place that people wanted to go to, whether they were members or not. The hotels promoted it. Everybody wanted to go to the Outrigger Canoe Club and enjoy the scenery and the pretty girls for good prices and to pay cash. Stop. More and more, each day, each week, each month, the club whole image and atmosphere changed from one that was strictly club to something that was semi-public. And this had very adverse effect on the membership and had a very direct effect upon subsequent decisions to not remain at that site. The board of directors had directed the planning committee to continue investigating the possibility of high-rise development at the new site at the Elks Club. And this we did for many, many months. And I should remind you that the only means of financing such an arrangement was as a co-op, because the act which provided for the horizontal property regime had not been instituted. At the same time, we were talking about planning facilities, even just in schematics for this Elks Club site. There were pressures upon the board of directors by developers, or potential developers, or pseudo-developers, at the old site. One in particular I remember is John Avent, who made a deal with the board of directors prior to my getting on, which would have him purchase the last couple of years of our sublease at the old site for a fee. And beside the fee, he would assist in speeding up or expediting the planning process for a building to be built down here at the Elks Club site. Eventually that particular scheme fizzled, and it's always burned me up because of the fact that we had to liquidate some of our building fund at a time when the market was depressed to pay for architectural renderings, etc., etc. And of course the whole thing came to a screaming halt later on when it turned out that Avent was not the substantial developer that he made himself out to be. As you know, the Waikiki Development Company had taken over the lease of all the Queen Emma properties, including the Outrigger Canoe Club, subject, of course, to the remaining leases in favor of Matson, the sublease in favor of the Outrigger Canoe Club.
About this time, do you recall approximately the condition of our sublease, that is, how long it had to go? And
well, I was, as I said, I was elected in 1960, and our sublease had until October 30th of 1963 to go. So we were faced that time with something like a little over 3.5 years to make up our minds and do it. So it's not very much time.
Did you know what the new rent might be or the new conditions?
I don't recall the conditions, but at the time I remember that they were it seemed way beyond our ability to pay, because even then there was nobody who had taken over the new premises. As it turned out, the successful lessee of the property was Roy Kelly, who eventually, as we know, built a hotel upon the site and named it the Outrigger. But we had nobody to deal with at that time. It was all, everything was very up in the air. But at any rate, through the year 1970, up to May 1972, my committee tried desperately to come up with some concept at the Elks Club which would include high-rise facilities and a club, all this at the direction of the board of directors. Now this is getting down to within 18 months of the end of our lease. And finally, on May 17th, 1962, the board of directors instructed my committee to stop all planning which involved a high-rise development and to proceed forthwith and with dispatch to design, finance a new club only. And we embarked upon that the very, very next day.
On the Outrigger, on the Elks Club site.
On the Elks Club site.
Right. The date is about what?
May 17th, 1962.
62?
Yes, 1962. Our committee of six, I think I can remember, Ward Russell, myself, Tom Wells, Hal Whitaker, Dickie Thacker, and Walter Collins was the planning committee. We had a companion committee which was called the Beach Development Committee, chaired by Keith Wallace. Also on the committee was myself and General Schmuck. And those gentlemen were charged with proceeding forthwith for the development of the new facilities. We had very little time to do it, but at the very outset, General Schmuck expressed his feeling, and we all followed, that the club would be ready for a party on Christmas Day for the membership, even if the club was not completely finished. At least it would be in such shape that we'd be able to enjoy a party. And that was the goal we had beginning May 18th, 1962.
So you had 18 months to get a feasibility study of what the club needed, put the plans together on paper, get the thing up and have a Christmas party. And you're starting from absolute scratch. Exactly. How'd you do it?
Well, I might just outline the things that had to be done. That's the first thing we did, is to outline what we had to do. The first thing was the development of a rather brief, very articulate program. This involved a membership utility of a certain number of people based upon a total membership of X number of people and a factor which allowed for the utility of those people. In other words, if you have 1,500 people in a club, roughly 500 people are using it all the time. And we decided that the factor would use the same factor, because everything was all guesswork, use the same factor of utility that was in use or which was apparently the factor at the old club. Of course, these are all guest figures, and you never know what those factors are going to be until after you build a new club. For example, we could have been completely wrong by developing a club which suddenly was so beautiful and so delightful and so and the prices of the food are so reasonable and the service so good that instead of having 500 or 33% utility, suddenly we had 66% utility. Then we'd find ourselves wall-to-wall people with nobody, with no room for it. Now that's the hazards of planning. On the other hand, if our quality was so bad, the service so poor, and the food so expensive, and the costs so high, and the dues were so high, that we went from 33 down to 15, of course we would have been defeated also. So everything was guesswork, and we just hoped the good Lord would smile on us. So the first thing was a program. And this was done within a week, and we got approval of the board of directors within a week. The architects had already been selected, firm of Val Ossipoff, and a companion firm of Wimley, Wisden & Allison, and Tom. We decided earlier, of course, that the primary architect for design was Val Ossipoff, and the specification writing would come from the other firm. Val himself took the lead in the design, as Val very often does. If you know people like Val, when he sees a site and he sees a potential, he puts himself into it like no other architect can. He was immediately in love with this site from the very first day, which made it very easy for us to get work out of the firm. The next thing, of course, was the preparation of schematics, traffic flow particularly, intermingling of cars and walk-ins and locker traffic and swimmers and snack bar traffic and dining room traffic and all of those intricate things that only somebody like Val Ossipoff can solve. At the same time, having a beautiful club, and we decided that we would do our best within our means to produce something of high quality without skimping on anything. This gets to finances. Beginning in 1958, you remember in those days the federal excise tax on dues was still in effect. And we were able to make the board of directors, this is 1958, before I was on the board, had provided for a supplement to income by setting forth an assessment to all regular members. So in addition to dues, there was an assessment for building purposes. And under the IRS regulations then enforced, that assessment amount was non-taxable, however the dues were. It wasn't until 1963 that Congress dumped that. And of course, it had an effect reducing the amount of money that most people call dues. However, the building of the Board of Directors from 1945 had established a building fund committee whose job was to accumulate funds from profits from operations. And this particular committee functioned very beautifully during the many years, or during the few years, during the war years, I should say, when the club was very highly profitable. I should say from 1945, 46, 47, 48 perhaps, which time the revenues of the club declined and we were in another bind. But a building fund had been started, had been nurtured by Les Hicks and his people, and this came largely from the initial profits from operations plus dividends and bond interest. So we were faced with that particular growing fund plus the accumulation of the assessments to the year 1963 when we anticipated moving into this spot. So we saw roughly a club that looked like it was going to cost about $1.25 million. And we had funds in the building fund estimated to come to about $700,000, which meant that we had to borrow roughly $550,000. We were very fortunate at this time in having on the Board of Directors a person by the name of Charles Peach, Jr., who had demonstrated a knack of financing projects such as the Kahala Hilton. And it was largely through his efforts that the two lead banks, Bishop Bank and Bank of Hawaii, were prevailed upon to loan the club $500,000. We didn't think we'd need the other $50,000 at the time. We eventually did. Borrowed it and paid it off on a short-term note. So we had to design and build a club costing $1,250,000. And the construction had to be agreement between the state of Hawaii, represented by its Department of Land and Natural Resources, the Board of Harbor Commissioners, and all of the owners and lessees abutting the proposed beach, namely the Elks and the Darrows. This particular document, which is recorded both in the land court system and in the regular system, was drafted by our attorneys and redrafted by government attorneys, and finally the task of getting all the signatures lodged on myself, who had to go around and get five trustees of the Elks and the other necessary corporate officers to sign. That authorized the beach to construction to commence, and that commenced in May of 1962 in what we call the first phase, which was the initial dredging in front of the Darrow property and in front of the outrigger portion of the Elks property. That particular plan of the beach was enlarged from phase one to phases two, three, and four over the next year and a half to embrace the construction of a low rock wall at the Diamond Head side of the Elks property, and a beautiful
lateral, I mean, a Blue Rock groin at the Honolulu side of the Darrow property. Almost from the very beginning, the first wall, namely the one on the Diamond Head side of the Alps, has been covered over with sand, and there are very few people today that know that that's in existence. But both walls are required for the stability of the beach that was eventually built. I might, at this particular point, say that we discovered something apparently that we many had known many years before, and that this land of Kapua, on which we situated, is in fact a large sand dune, which extends all the way from the Kaiman Hotel boundary, which is owned by the McInerneys, all the way to Coconut Avenue, and extends all the way up to the limestone cliffs where the old Heiau used to be, and of course La Pietra in more recent years. All of this sand lay below about a foot and a half layer of dirt, and we were able to plan for and subsequently did get approximately 11,000 cubic yards of beautiful beach sand just from the excavation of this particular property that we're on. All of this became a part of the public domain when it was placed on the beach. And to make up much of the void where we had taken the sand, we enlarged the dredging of the lagoon so that the coral taken from the lagoon could go back and replace the sand that had been removed. The intent of my description of the land of Kapua was to say that we knew from excavations by the state, the city, and others in the vicinity, such as pipelines, water lines, sewer lines, that much sand was available, and that we had tested this particular site and knew that sand was available eventually at such time that we would actually get to the beach construction as opposed to the initial dredging. Stop.
Okay. So I gather that with this construction that has started, you had the clearance to borrow the money and to go ahead. Is that correct?
That's right. The sum and substance of the meeting of November 1962 was that the membership was pleased with the plans as presented, and when request was made for authority, the board was given authority to proceed with the final plans, let the construction out to bid, to execute the contract for a total cost not to exceed $1,200,000, and to borrow such funds as would be required.
Was there any static from a large vocal minority, or did it go through pretty clearly, pretty smoothly?
That particular meeting went through pretty smoothly.
Uh-huh.
And I can only say that it was because of the careful planning that went in and the finesse with which the architect depicted a beautiful club which would be someday on the site. Now, this is in November 1962. Mind you, we have to be out. Our lease goes to October 30th. Even then, we were making plans to extend our tenure at that site.
October 30th, 1963.
Yep. Extend our tenure mm-hmm. with whomever the new lessee might be. As it turned out, it was Roy Kelly, member of the Outrigger Canoe Club also, and I can't remember the date at which time we proposed this to him, but the bottom line was that he had no firm plans to occupy the premises as of October 30th or 31st, 1963. He had no plans as yet, and we entered into an agreement with Roy Kelly to extend our tenure there at the site for 2 full months, to December 31st, 1963. This gave the Planning and Committee extra time. Of course, we needed it, although we'd already promised ourselves that we were going to have a party on Christmas Day of 1963. Well, we were faced with a very, very severe time frame, and it became very obvious that we'd have to make special plans to construct a facility in phases. And a very clever arrangement was devised by General Schmuck, who at that time was an officer or employee with the Hawaiian Dredging Company. And he was instrumental in having Hawaiian Dredging Company, through its president, Lowell Dillingham, propose to the Outrigger Canoe Club that it would be in the club's best interest to do as much site work at the site prior to asking for bids from the general contractor. It was hoped, and it was planned, as it turned out, it was true, that we saved about 2 months. And what this meant was that the old structures and the entire site would be cleared, and the basic excavation on the site would take place, so that any contractor who would bid on the club facilities would be faced with an absolute, immaculate, clean site to start with. At the same time, the next beach development stage could go on. Meanwhile, all the time, the plans are for the building are being completed. So we weren't wasting any time at all, we're saving it. The board of directors was very impressed by this proposal. So Lowell Dillingham's suggestion was approved by the board of directors, and within a matter of a few weeks, we had entered into a contract for the next phase of beach development, which involved the building of a beautiful groin on the town side of the Colony Surf, the enlarging of the dredging area, the clearing of demolishing of all the old buildings, and the excavating. And this involved removing every single plant, tree, vine on the old premises, with one exception. That's the monkey pod that's on the left-hand side of the premises as one comes in. And, of course, from the very beginning, we had planned that a large percentage of our budget would be for new landscaping to take place of all the trees that had to be removed. So, as we moved into January, February, the site is cleared, the beach development next phase is complete, we're ready to go to bid, and the bids were in the hands of the contractors at the time of the annual meeting of the membership of the Outrigger Canoe Club in February of 1963.
So now you're 10 months away from the Christmas party and we don't have the club up yet, okay?
We haven't started it yet.
That's right.
I should back up just briefly to say that shortly after the meeting of the annual meeting, or the special meeting of the membership of November 1962, the board went ahead to securing financing. Charlie Peach on our board was very instrumental in getting two banks to commit to a $500,000 loan. I might give you the terms for your information. Terms were $500,000, a repayment period of 15 years with no points, and interest at the rate of 6 1/4% per annum.
Oh, and that's very nice, very nice.
Which was the mere fact that a club was able to secure financing in the first place was enough to shock a lot of people. The terms of that particular loan were even more shocking.
It's about one-third the amount of interest that you'd have to pay today if you could get the loan.
Exactly. Now, we didn't make use of that loan until many months later, and the idea was that we would first liquidate the fund that we had and then call upon the loan to finish the project. But I announced to the membership at the February annual meeting that the contractors had had possession of plans and specifications, and we had decided to give them all a decent amount of time so that all the factors relating to the project would be well known to all. The hope, of course, being that we would get very favorable bids. At the same time, the planning committee discerned in one of our colleagues on the board, George Freitas, certainly regarded as one of the top contractors in all of Hawaii, was impressed, or at least he seemed to be, impressed with the plans that he was called upon to approve. He was impressed by the manner in which the architect presented the new plans to the special meeting. And we all felt George would want to build the club. It appeared to be a prestigious project, appeared to have all the quality that we would be very proud in owning. So the day for opening of bids was a very important day in our lives, and that was in the third week of March, 1963. And the good Lord smiled upon us again. The lowest bid was, in fact, Pacific Construction. And it was the bid that they offered was considerably below what we had budgeted. My recollection, something in the order of $80,000.
Less than your budget.
Less than our budget.